This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode, Science Interrupted, The Impact of Coronavirus. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Every April, Dan Blumstein skis to the crested Butte Mountains of Colorado. Picture majestic, snowy, white mountain peaks dotted with evergreens, blue skies. Dan doesn't come here for that view, though.
We ski in, and then every morning we're up and we go out and look for any sign of burrows being opened, and then wait for animals to emerge.
The animals he's waiting for are marmots. They come out of hibernation that time of year. Dan is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at UCLA, and he runs the Marmot Project at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab.
As soon as they start coming out, we begin identifying them to understand who's out. We begin doing social observations on them.
Marmots are cute and playful. They look a little bit like groundhogs or super chubby squirrels. The Rocky Mountain Biological Lab in Colorado has been studying yellow-bellied marmots for decades.
This is the longest-term data set on marmots. It's one of the longest-term data sets on mammals, and it's one of the longest-term data sets in the world on anything.
For all those years, they followed these animals from furry cradle to grave, so to speak. How many babies do they have? How do they live? When do they die? How do they die? Marmots live in social groups, and the researchers look at how they cooperate or compete. They also track population increases and decreases.
The study also has provided a window on climate change, because our Colorado study site has been getting warmer, and the marmots have, on average, been getting up earlier in the year. And this has consequences for population growth and local extinctions.
This spring, the researchers were looking forward to the marmots coming out of hibernation, but
probably in February, I started realizing that we're going to have some issues this summer.
The area experienced a pretty widespread outbreak of COVID-19. The county shut down in early March, and that meant the field study was off. And this kind of thing has happened all over the country, all over the world. Xavier Lopez picks up the story from here.
So the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab has halted all research for now. The first break in a chain that has spanned for almost 100 years. Here's Dan Blumstein again.
The Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory has been going since the 20s, and people studied things through the Great Depression. People studied things through World War II. People studied things through the Korean War. We all studied things through the 2008-2009 global economic downturn. And this is really the first thing that's stopping research.
Science projects everywhere have come to a grinding halt.
I think we got to the boat on a Friday, and we're supposed to go out that next Monday, and in between the Friday and Monday, the trip got canceled.
That's Caitlin Frazier, a project scientist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. She studies marine mammal acoustics.
We build underwater acoustic recording devices, and they sit on the seafloor and record for about a year at a time. And they collect all sorts of sounds that marine mammals make underwater. And so then we ask all sorts of questions from those recordings about where animals go and in response to what environmental conditions. Are there more this year than last year?
Caitlin and her team go out into the ocean, and they'll take two or three of these recording devices with them. They drop them overboard at specific locations that they're interested in studying. From these recordings, they try to understand how climate change is impacting marine life.
You really need a long period of time to watch natural variation and impacts of different events. So we have, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico, a 10-year time series that we've been maintaining since the Deepwater Horizon spill. And this spring, we were supposed to start collecting the next 10 years of data. And, you know, there goes that time series. For now, there's going to be a huge blank spot in the middle of that data set, which isn't the end of the world, but the longer it goes on, the less useful those data become.
Caitlin's team was supposed to retrieve a bunch of these devices from the ocean floor to install new batteries and collect the data from their hard drives. This would give them enough space and life to collect another year's worth of data.
So a bunch of those trips got canceled. So we're trying as best we can, when possible, to still get out on small boats and service instruments that are within reach, but many of them are just so far offshore that you need big government vessels to get out there. So those are just waiting for us
Caitlin says that missing out on these field experiments for a few months won't be a huge problem, but it becomes a bigger issue if this goes on for a longer period of time. When the gap in the data spans over a year and the batteries die, the internal system that signals the oceanographers to the device's location will fail, and the instruments will be left on the seafloor, abandoned like the decaying Titanic. While Caitlin and Dan are the first to admit that the research setbacks don't rank among the most significant effects of the pandemic, this type of data collection is still very important and could have rippling effects.
If you're trying to establish how the ocean is storing carbon and then you have this gap of a couple of years, it can totally change your estimates of how much the ocean is influencing climate change. And I think that's the case in a lot of research where the value of the data is in being able to consistently collect that data.
That's Claudia Guy. She's a journalist based in Massachusetts, focusing on environmental and marine science.
If you don't have that, you're going to be not publishing data. You're going to be not influencing the policy that might rely on that data.
Claudia says that some of these research gaps might have more dire consequences than others.
Actually, the horror story that was the spookiest for me was speaking to a guy who does research on emerging diseases. So he's looking at how malaria is spread in Cameroon when deforestation allows birds and other species to move out of their normal habitats and come into contact with humans. And so it's very spooky to think about the fact that we're missing out on data that could then contribute to the next pandemic, the next disease that jumps from animals to humans, just like this one did.
Many of the repercussions of this lack of data gathering are still unknown, in part because everything is changing so rapidly. Some of these places might soon be opening up again. Dan might still be able to perform his marmot observations by the start of summer, and Caitlin might be able to retrieve her Cassowary recording equipment. But one thing that Claudia, Caitlin, and Dan all agreed on is that these disruptions are really going to impact early career scientists the most.
A lot of the new experiments I was going to try out this summer actually are pretty critical to my dissertation, at least how I have it laid out currently.
That's Kwasi Rensford. He's a third-year PhD candidate at UC Berkeley. He's been studying the effects of climate change on two types of chipmunks that live on the Sierra Nevada mountain range in California, in hopes of gaining insights into how animals and humans adjust to warming temperatures. This summer, he was planning on going back to the Sierra Nevada mountains to install digital transponders called pit tags that would help him track these chipmunks better.
And with those pit tags, I can get really good data about year-to-year survival from these individuals that I wasn't necessarily able to get previously. And if I'm not able to get that done this summer, it'll seem unlikely that I'll be able to get that done in time to finish my PhD.
Sarika Khanwilkar is another early career scientist in a similar situation. She's a student from Columbia University, also in the third year of her PhD.
I was in India in January. I was on a Fulbright student scholarship. And I was supposed to be there until, you know, the following January 2021, at least.
This summer, Sarika was going to start a project where she would place sound recorders in the forest to measure out biodiversity. But as the outbreak picked up speed, she realized she couldn't stay there anymore. Both Kwasi and Sarika's fieldwork is relying on grant funding that was secured only for this year, 2020. For Sarika, the U.S. State Department ended all Fulbright funding in June, which meant that even if she had stayed in India, she wouldn't have been able to conduct her research.
One of the, you know, strong points of being a part of being a Fulbright researcher is your ability to have that support when getting permits to work in certain places, which can be one of the largest hurdles to doing field research in a foreign country. And once that support was going to be over, there really was no reason for me to stay in India. So now I'm back living with my parents, which isn't something that I thought would ever happen.
Ian Billick is the executive director of the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. He's concerned about what this type of large-scale fieldwork disruption will mean for the future of our world. He says fieldwork is very important to our understanding of biology, of viruses, and how they travel between humans and animals. Take, for example, the hantavirus, spread by rodents. It can cause respiratory disease in humans.
We know that the hantavirus, which has been a very serious virus, a lot of the critical epidemiology was worked out at a field station. And so what it feels like to me is it's an opportunity for the world to wake up to the seriousness of the environmental issues that we're dealing with and to start investing in the science that's going to be needed in order to manage the environmental challenges.
Ian says the amount of money that the United States spends on field research is essentially nothing. In fact, he says that a lack of investment in the sciences might be one of the reasons we were caught by surprise when the coronavirus appeared.
We need to invest in long-term research well beyond what we're currently investing in. We need to be able to identify emerging disease. We need to understand the interface between wildlife and disease. The coronavirus, it emerged at the interface between humans and wildlife, you know, bats and pangolins. So field stations are one of the best places to understand how that interface is working.
That story was reported by Xavier Lopez.